Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Good morning, Rabideau.
Good morning, good morning. And we're still in London, and we've got some more exciting adventures for you. But I think it's worth noting that there's an invasion going on. I guess Paul Revere, was it Paul Revere who said the British are coming, the British are coming, the British are coming?
Yes.
Well, in London.
I think you're going the wrong direction with this here.
In London, what's going on right now is the Yanks are coming. The Yanks are coming.
Yeah, well, somewhat.
And we didn't catch up with Jean-Georges Van Gerichten, who rumor said was opening a spice market restaurant in London while we were there. We were not able to verify whether that actually happened.
But we did. February 14th, Valentine's Day.
Okay, but we did catch up with two invasions from across the big pond, both of which are in their own way being immensely successful and attracting a lot of attention.
You know, when I look over the list of who we interviewed and recall the dinners we had and the lunches we had, no wonder I have to be at the gym every morning now, because I ate so many, well, they called them chips, but they're French fries, and boy, were they good.
Well,
I love those.
Anyway, first up in today's program, Bob Boulou, transplanted from New York, and including some of the key features from some of Danielle's other fine restaurants in New York City, headed up by Chef Dean Yossarian, who worked at Bar Boulou in New York and actually opened the Bar Boulou.
And I mean, it's not just transplanted. I mean, it's an additional Bar Boulou. Let's not confuse that.
Okay, well, excuse me. I think it sort of gets explained in the interview anyway.
Yeah, well, it will.
How the concept developed. So in what used to be the wonderful Hyde Park Hotel, which is now the Brent's spanking new exciting Mandarin Oriental, right at Knightsbridge, Bar Boulou.
It's fascinating to be in Bar Boulou in London, since we've spent so much time in Bar Boulou in New York City. And we're talking to the executive chef here, Dean Yossarian, who turns out is a transplanted Pennsylvanian. And welcomed on the menu, Dean.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Now, you worked at Bar Boulou in Manhattan.
Yep, I was a part of the opening at Bar Boulou in Manhattan, I guess almost 3 years ago, with Damian Sansonetti.
Who's also a native Pennsylvanian.
Yep, proud to say.
We're taking over the world.
We are. You know, I think at one point we had three or four Pennsylvanians in the kitchen in New York, so it was fun.
Now, the setup is probably pretty identical, isn't it, or is it?
I would say it's almost identical, slightly larger space. The menu, you know, we still have the collaboration with Gilles Verreau, with the charcuterie. A lot of the bistro staples that we have in New York are on the menu. With the addition of some influences from our other restaurants, DBGB.
Oh, I love DBGB.
So we've taken on the shellfish station from DBGB,
the
burgers and the sausages as well. So it's, you know, it's a bigger kitchen, more sort of sections, because we brought in those aspects. Very much still feels like Bar Boulou.
Bar Boulou. And I love the bar where you look into you can eat at this bar and then look into the kitchen.
Yeah, we have the charcuterie bar, which, you know, it has the sort of sushi display case of the charcuterie, the terrines, the pâtés and the hams, like as it is in New York, but we still do have a real bar, which Bar Boulou in New York does not have.
Okay, so you have a semicircular bar or a quarter circle bar, and then a straight line facing the food.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, how is this received? I've heard nothing but praise about it, of course. We haven't even mentioned it. It's in the Mandarin Oriental Hotel, a very prestigious hotel, which has become known for Bar Boulou and dinner by Heston Blumenthal. It's become known as a real gourmet destination.
Yeah, I think the collaboration with Mandarin Oriental was fantastic from the beginning, and I think a lot of that praise goes to David Nichols for bringing the sort of the different companies together as a new concept for the Mandarin Oriental moving forward worldwide. He's, you know, David's sort of, I think, creating this new concept where Mandarin Oriental is bringing in well-known chefs.
And this is David Nichols is the
David Nichols is the executive food and beverage director worldwide, and also taking care of a lot of the openings with the food and beverage in the Mandarin Orientals.
So this is something that we can look forward to happening.
Yeah, I think you're going to see more and more big names of chefs with Mandarin Oriental.
That's interesting, because you used to find that with Ritz-Carlton. They seem to have fallen by the wayside a little bit, haven't they?
Yeah, I think this Mandarin Oriental in London sort of new transformation with Dinner by Heston and Danielle Ballou is sort of the start, something bigger, you know, for Mandarin Oriental in terms of food and beverage.
Great. Now, you moved here with your wife.
Yep.
And I asked you, how did you like it? I mean, it's a big change from Amish country in Pennsylvania, and it's even a different kind, but a big change from Manhattan.
Yeah, when I got into the restaurant business, it was in Pennsylvania, and I did my schooling just outside of Penn State in a small town called Williamsport, Pennsylvania. I then actually came to the UK after I graduated school
because I did
a year in Cambridge. I had a sister who was married into the U.S. military. So she was stationed here. It was kind of my ticket in to travel. So I was very fortunate to get involved with a chef named Daniel Clifford from Midsummer House in Cambridge.
That's Peter's alma mater. I don't know.
Yeah, two-star Michelin restaurant there. Fantastic experience.
There was never any two-star Michelin anywhere near the place when I was there.
Yeah, I think there may be another star there now, but for the longest time he was kind of the place to go. So yeah, that was
so
my
you knew the country.
Yeah, I knew the country. I knew a bit about the restaurant scene in London and also the rest of the country, and was very much into it.
It's changed though so dramatically. It's like, boy, I mean,
yeah,
any place.
The last 20 years,
if you find good restaurants in like Manchester and you know, Leeds.
Now, were you in London during that stay? Or?
No, I was in Cambridge.
Just in Cambridge.
I had a little issue with the working visa, so then I returned back to the States, where I went straight to New York and started to work for Danielle Ballou at Restaurant Danielle.
Okay, so you're at Danielle.
Yeah, so you're at the mothership.
I was at Danielle's flagship three-star Michelin restaurant in the Upper East Side, Manhattan. Yeah, it was still to this day probably one of my best dining experiences, even after working there for 2 years.
It was fabulous. We met last time we were in New York. I guess we met Danielle at Cafe Ballou, mm-hmm. And he said, "Have you been over since we remodeled the bar, Danielle?" And we said, "No." He said, "Well, come on over tonight if you're not doing anything."
Mm-hmm.
And have a glass of champagne and a little bite. 4 hours later, we left, having had a wonderful dining experience. And the remodels made it look even more splendid than it was before.
Yeah, I had the opportunity to eat both before and after the remodeling, yeah. And yeah, I tell you, the room is completely different.
Oh, it's so much lighter and better. Yeah, I love it.
Which was redesigned by Adam Tihany,
yeah.
Which is also responsible for the design of this.
Oh, he did.
Tihany
did this
yeah.
one, too. I don't know how he fits all these restaurants in. He's every time you find a nicely designed restaurant, it's Adam's.
Yeah.
Now, tell me this. How have you, London, British customer, how is the British customer, how is the London customer different from, say, your New York customer? I mean, there's a long history of French restaurants in London, but so there is an acceptance built in, sort of. But give me your take on it.
Well, I think New York in itself, you know, having spent 6 years there, absolutely love the city. But even because it's such a large restaurant community in New York, I think, and a lot of chefs will agree with me that work in various areas of Manhattan, there's the clientele very much differs from in Manhattan alone and all the different areas, you know, the Upper East Side, Upper West Side, East Side,
Brooklyn,
you know, there's all very much different clientele in each area there. So I would say on the Upper West Side, you know, the clientele is, we do have a lot of neighborhood customers as well as obviously a large theater crowd, which I think tends to be sort of middle-aged.
Just like us, huh?
Yeah. I would say, you know, there's slightly older crowd, but.
Also just like us.
Yeah. Sorry about that.
It's okay. How about the...
But the clientele in London, I think, they were Knightsbridge here, which is, you know...
Upscale.
Upscale, you know, the best... Said to be some of the best shopping, you know, with Harrods and Harvey Nichols. And, of course, the Mandarin Oriental being a five-star hotel brings in... Yeah, it definitely brings in sort of an upscale clientele. But with that said, you know, we still very much a casual restaurant. We've been able to bring in quite a wide variety of customers, I would say.
And you've gotten high ratings in your formal reviews.
Yeah, I mean, all the formal reviews were very positive right from the get-go.
Now, what are you doing about you're sourcing some of your things, like a charcuterie is coming from the same kind of program, although you have a man on site who actually does it for you, like in New York. Mm-hmm. But what about some of the other, I won't say peculiarly English, but English available products that you have? I think the pork you're getting here is probably very different than what you can get in the States.
Yeah, the charcuterie program is very much the same as it is in New York, with a charcutier on site who's trained by Gilles Verreau, who we had the collaboration with, and the recipes that are 3-4 generations old. The product, so we're getting closer to the roots of where the recipes are derivative, which would be France. We originally opened using the same product as Gilles uses in France, because that was a product that he knew, he didn't, you know, that,
yeah, right,
wasn't very far away, that we, you know, it wasn't that difficult to bring it in. So we sort of started out with the French product that we knew, product tested with Gilles for years. But we very much wanted to get in and use the local pork, because, you know, England is quite well known for,
oh,
you know,
sure,
for its pig,
yeah,
its pork farming. And
it's nice,
so yeah, we
black pigs.
Yeah, and then you have the black pigs from Spain as well. But no, we, over the last 6 months, I would say we've visited some different farms here in England, and, you know, different suppliers. So we're able to now use the local pork, you know, that now that we've had time to test it, and very happy with it.
Now, you said you're also doing seafood?
Yeah, we're doing seafood. A lot of it comes locally from the south coast of England, from Scotland, from Ireland, and then obviously we still get product from France, Brittany, also the Mediterranean.
Well, now, are we in for any kind of surprises?
As compared to Barbaloo in New York? Well, like I say, the menu is, you know, it's
more
a little
expensive.
Bit bigger. We've brought in, yeah, price-wise, I would say, well, of course, if you do the pound ratio to...
Yeah, I didn't mean to say expensive. I meant to say extensive.
Oh, extensive, yeah. I'm sorry. I thought you said expensive.
Quite different meaning there.
No, surprises compared to New York's menu, I would say, you know, with the addition of the sausages, we have probably 4 to 6 different sausages, as opposed to Barbaloo in New York's menu. They have, you know, the traditional Boudin Blanc, Boudin Noir, which are fantastic. But along with those, you know, we brought in, you know, the Tunisienne. We have a Beaujolais, which is a sort of a red wine pork sausage, which is coarse ground with bacon and onions. And
that's good.
Very, very good. The Tunisienne, which is a lamb merguez sausage,
yeah, right,
with a bit of a Moroccan influence, a little couscous, pepper stew, a little bit of yogurt sauce. It's very nice. Goes over very well with the local Arabic, you know, clientele that we have here in the Mandarin and in Knightsbridge, for that matter.
It sounds like you have a much larger palate to work.
Yeah, I mean, learning more and more about the charcuterie, and a little bit more about the French roots of some of these different sausages coming from different areas of different regions of France.
And of course, you're not the same as in Manhattan, where the Blue Empire has several different ones, including Bistro Deluxe and Café Blue, which aren't represented here in London, I suppose, yet would be a way of describing it as a possibility.
Yeah, I think being that it's Danielle's first sort of European outpost, we wanted to bring in as many influences from the company as we could. So, you know, there are little bits of Barbaloo is the main concept, but there are little influences from DB Bistro, from DBGB, from Café Blue. You know, within the company, we still very much have a network of similar recipes we know that work. So it's kind of, I would say, it's taken a little piece of all the different concepts into one.
So if you're a Danielle fan, this would be the place to get your fix if you're in,
yeah,
the UK.
That's for sure.
I would say so, yes.
Thank you so much for talking to us, and I look forward to
We're looking forward to getting our Danielle fix.
Yeah, right.
Absolutely.
Thanks a lot.
Yep, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
And now stay with us while we take a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, and boy, did I have a good time at Barbaloo. I mean, I love the one in New York, but I really like the one in London a lot. And they have more choices even. It extends to some of the other Blue restaurants that I love with their offerings.
And a hot tip for you, if you're planning to go, be sure to make a reservation, because this place sure is popular.
Oh, it really rocks, doesn't it?
It really does.
Rocking place is coming up next, Barbacoa. Is that how you pronounce it?
Barbacoa. And if you can imagine a combination of the what formerly known as the Naked Chef, famous Jamie Oliver from the United Kingdom, and Adam Perry Lang from the United States. Adam's now a transplant, having moved his entire family to London to get involved in this fabulous new project in the city of London, right close to St. Paul's Cathedral. Let's hear what Adam had to say to us.
I'm actually moving in on the tail end of a dream realized here, talking to Adam Perry Lang at his restaurant in London, Barbacoa. It was like 9 months ago, which is, I guess, a really nice gestation period for humans, though not necessarily for restaurants,
right,
from my experience.
Yes.
But you said you were going into this venture with Jamie Oliver, and it was going to be opening, and it was going to be American barbecue, or just barbecue, in London.
Yeah.
And then we walked in the door, and here's the reality.
Yes, welcome.
Well, welcome indeed. It really is a gorgeous restaurant.
Thank you.
Smart restaurant.
Thank you very much.
Jam-packed,
yeah,
with people who love
busy.
It.
Very
yeah.
Fun.
First of all, let's step back a little bit. What gave you the idea for this restaurant?
I think it was Jamie and I. We were sitting down in my restaurant in New York, Daisy May's Barbecue.
Oh, Daisy May's.
Yeah,
okay.
And so we were just having a good time, and we clicked, we bonded. And from that point on, we became friends. So the interest was there, not necessarily to do a business, but just we just clicked with barbecue. We then later went on a trip together, going skiing in Switzerland. And over a bottle of red wine, we just kind of chatted about some different possibilities. And then the dream was born.
Now, this restaurant is in a new development, which I think is really intriguing. I love the way they use the shades to fog up the windows,
yes,
and it's really smart.
Yeah, it is.
It's loaded with restaurants, but you seem to be getting your share of the business.
Well, I know. If you look at the whole development, I think it's quite busy. It's just we're just at a different price point. So it's a city clientele. So I think everybody's doing quite well, at least the numbers around us. So we've been hearing that. So, but we're doing quite well. It's nice, knock wood, and keep it going.
Now, you were from Brooklyn, and
yeah,
I said to you, aren't you surprised at where Brooklyn has ended up being as a culinary hotspot? And you said no, that you already expected it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that New York is a funny machine, and there's always room for expansion, but there's never enough space. So any neighborhood that once was not looked on so fondly as a destination has become, by virtue of overflow and demand and the culture of food in general. So it didn't really surprise me too much. It was a matter of time. It was just which restaurateurs were going to be first to actually take the plunge in and just to start doing the movement.
So, but now, how did you decide you were going to move to London? It's very different from New York.
Well, I think that the kids are young enough, and I met my wife in France. She's French and British, so it was a nice opportunity for us to move without tearing up their lives too much, and for them to experience something different, and also for us to feel adventure and feel excited about doing something. And it's been just that. I mean, we absolutely love living here, and I commute back and forth to the States, but raising a family here has been quite nice.
It's really quite amazing. So you have a lot of foot traffic, people walking from work, coming here for lunch. What about dinner time? We were here at lunchtime. Lunchtime, it's packed. What happens after 5?
It's pretty similar. I mean, although the demographic over the weekend changes, because you'd liken this place similar to Wall Street. You get more families,
oh, yeah,
a lower spend per head. But surprisingly so, it's just it's quite popular. I think this area that we're in has good shopping, so I liken it to somewhat of a coral reef where fish can gather. So.
Ah, that's cute. You thought about that, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Or it's a herd of sheep.
Yeah, I guess so.
Or a flock of geese. Or
I guess so, yeah.
Group of cows.
Exactly.
Would be more appropriate.
Exactly.
But we are literally a stone's throw from the east end of St. Paul's Cathedral. Now, in the development, they did a very sympathetic treatment of the aspect. But what did people in general think about a development right close to a
fascinating national heritage place.
I don't think people initially thought it was going to be anything really more than what it was, a shopping complex inside. But for me, it represented more. It had the same spirit as what the Time Warner Center did in New York, which you had higher-end restaurants in more of a shopping center type area. So
it's curious. I said to Anne, I said, that's what this development reminds me
that,
of.
It reminds me of
Time Warner Center. I mean, the scale is slightly smaller, but it's got the same kind of feel about it.
I knew the public would, are at least capable of assimilating that and not feeling as if it's an oddity, because it works, as you can tell. But at the same time, I don't necessarily know people initially outside of understanding that blueprint would have understood that.
What are your guests most excited about? I mean, this is American barbecue. These are all foods we all know well. What is it that you found that people have noticed
different? I don't necessarily liken it to American barbecue as much as I do cooking with wood and coal and natural forms of cooking, because there's lots of different influences on this menu, and it's not just from me, obviously. It's from my partner, Jamie, who puts his feelings in it, and we're great at collaborating. So one of the greatest draws, I think, here is that we have that added commitment, I guess, to cooking over wood and charcoal, which brings a load of flavors to the table that you wouldn't normally find. And also our commitment to sourcing and quality and caring of what we're procuring. So I think that's where we're a viable, fantastic restaurant in this landscape.
And you're getting some really good meat.
Yeah, all around.
That's
absolutely.
All
everything's
British
really
sauce,
well sourced.
Local.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I never understood what drew you to barbecue to start with.
I think that for me, I like all forms of cooking. It was just I was a little bit at that point, although I kind of bounced back and forth, I was a little bit tired of just thinking about things from just a very costly, higher-end type of cuisine. And I just really was just a little bit anti-restaurant in general and wanted to just do something very primal with meat, fire, and just get on with it and not really over-intellectualize, but put the same caring and passion into that to just simplify it and just have a lot of restraint. And so that's what drew me toward it. It was just a reaction of just...
You've avoided this whole politic thing of what kind of barbecue. You just do what you like on the menu.
Yeah, I mean, I've traveled around. I think that nowadays it's a little bit old guard just to think about it overly regional, because reality, we're all well-traveled. Back in the day when that was really viable, people really didn't get to go to the Carolinas, and people from the Carolinas didn't really get out too much, so they had a very distinctive region to work with. And now you still feel that, but people are more well-traveled, and I think that just to not use an ingredient because they've done it like
right,
in the past.
Can
it's silly.
With
now
it,
everything's
right.
available, so why not use it?
Now let's just go through some of the things we really liked that we ate for lunch. Starting out with, sort of uncharacteristically, I thought your garden salad was, market salad, was fabulous.
Oh, thanks.
And then we would always do that, and it was served with a sherbet vinaigrette, but it was so fresh. Where do you go? Do you have purveyors? Do you go to markets locally? What?
Well, I mean, I think that the key thing is that we have purveyors that go to markets locally, although I do spend a good amount of my time during the week to forage.
Do you?
I think it comes
you forage?
Down.
Where do you forage?
Well, I mean, forage from the point of view of not only I'll go pick some mushrooms and do some things and go to the abattoirs, but also work alongside some of these people that are out doing it. I'm not going to...
This is a whole new side of you. I didn't know.
Yeah, I mean, but I think a lot of chefs are particularly interested in the chase and the hunt for the product. But our purveyors really help us with that. So, I mean, aside from just getting a typical mix of whatever there is, I mean, we're getting.
Chips, I tell you, I resisted, but Peter overrode me. And we had these absolutely marvelous chips. What is Volpaia vinegar?
It's just a very, subtle, yet it has a nice acidity, mild vinegar that I think lends itself to the chips itself. It's supposed to be too overdramatic, and that's one of Jamie was really fond of that vinegar. And we're cooking the chips in goose fat, which just makes a huge difference. I wasn't really too crazy about the oils that are used to fry here. And
well, I loved what you ever used. I loved it.
Yes.
Now, how do you and Jamie decide who's input is going to go on the menu.
It's not who's. I mean, I think it's not a question of who I got this and that. It's just really just the dynamic of this project, which you could say is strange when you have two chefs collaborating and you say, well, who's the one who picks it? But it's not like that at all. I mean, we have a real love and passion for food in general. And, you know, these dishes are often just expressions of our conversations of things that we find interesting. On any given day, you know, we can have five different dishes and they all could be wonderful, but we just kind of go for it and we have fun doing it.
Well, let me run through what we had. And if you feel you want to say anything about any of these dishes, jump in and annotate. Starting, we had crispy pig cheeks with autumn piccalilli, which Peter freaked out over because he grew up with it, and lamb's lettuce. Baby back ribs with crunchy apple, coriander, shredded cabbage. It was a coleslaw kind of.
Yeah.
With jalapeno and citrus salad. You recommended most of these. Then, I mean, I had the lamb leg steak with cannellini beans, rocket, and the beans were in a tomato sauce.
Right.
And then these incredible short ribs that
I had a short rib that came from a rhinoceros, I think.
Oh, yeah.
they're big.
Yeah, they are big.
Which is the other thing to mention, these portions are huge for a British restaurant.
Yeah, it's true.
And do people really want that?
Well, I mean, if I have a little bit extra, it's okay. It has more to do with the cooking and a lot of the steaks, how they cut them here. I don't think they lend themselves to develop much flavor. They get cooked, but cook a steak very quickly over charcoal, you lose a lot of what you got going on. So I'd like to cut it thick and give a little bit more than have to, and then have a little bit extra than to sacrifice the cooking. So it's really about.
And the wine list is extensive.
Yeah, it is.
We had, what was our wine? It was fabulous.
Paul picked it. We gave Paul the task of picking a big red.
Yeah.
And I love this man because he served as an Amarone, which went beautifully with barbecue.
Oh, yeah, it's brilliant.
That's exactly what it was made for.
Yeah, no, I'm so pleased you enjoyed it. It's great.
There's one other element to the program that we shouldn't miss out, although we haven't been there yet. Downstairs is a butcher shop.
Yes.
Yeah, no, we have
which
to go
is
look
part
at
of
that.
The same,
yeah,
part
love
of the same
that.
Complex, so no wonder you do good meat.
Yeah, no, that's kind of our window into it, so that's part of it. I mean, it's chefs who like to play with the products and bring it in, so.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on the menu.
You.
It was a pleasure. I'm so glad that we had the chance to do this.
It's a pleasure to have you.
Can we spell this just in case anybody wants to look it up on the internet, which is Barbecoa.
That's right. Barbecoa. That's right.
Is it then .com or is there a restaurant there?
Yeah, exactly.
Great.
Exactly.
Thanks
you so much.
Adam Perry Lang.
Yes.
I love your name, by the way.
Did you
were born with that name?
Adam Perry, but my stepfather, his last name's Lang.
Give him credit because it's a fabulous
name.
Thank
you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Adam.
Okay, thank you.
Bye. We will talk about a wonderful, vibrant place that is. And, of course, don't forget downstairs that absolutely amazing butcher shop.
Yeah.
Did you ever see such gorgeous meat?
I'm sure I have, but it's been a long time. I wanted to take some home, but obviously we couldn't do that.
No.
Anyway, the one thing we must take now is we must take a short break and stay with us because we'll be back with more adventures on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, you know, we never stop in London without looking up our good buddy, Eddie Hart.
Sometimes it's his brother, Sam.
Or with Sam Hart. Eddie and Sam they have their fingers on the pulse of what's going on in London. And if you want to get really caught up in what's happening, you talk to them. And they have an interesting group of friends, too, because all their places are filled with interesting people.
Anyway, first up, we heard this rumor that cocktails were becoming exciting in London again, and of course Sam and Eddie had to have a finger in that. So we said, well, Eddie and Sam, we got to stop by and talk to you about your cocktail program. So we did. It turned out that they've been doing it for quite a while, but interestingly enough, just retrofitted a part of their Quo Vadis restaurant to make it into a bar so that you don't have to be a member of their dining club to be able to imbibe these delicious things which bartender Paul makes together with his colleagues. And then we couldn't resist grabbing Eddie for a few minutes and talking to him about the latest rumors about what's going on in London. What they're up to, what they're not up to, what's the dirt.
I said dish, which is a little bit more appetizing.
Well, we left some of the dirt out, but there's certainly a lot of dishing going on as to what's going on in the London dining scene. So here's Eddie Hart, and first of all, before that, bartender Paul.
Well, cocktails are supposed to be American, but the cocktail craze, or maybe I shouldn't call it a craze, enthusiasm, has hit the UK and particularly London, and we're pleased to be at Quo Vadis Club that has a smart bar, talking to it's called the club manager, Paul Mant, but I mean, you are preferably called, you would prefer to be called, what, bar manager,
depends on what time of day and which day of the week.
Mixologist?
Never.
Never. Bar chef?
Also never.
Okay, so it's either bartender or a club manager.
I'm a mixologist or a bar chef when it pays better to be, so I suppose.
I imagine bar chefs get paid better, don't you?
Depends which country you're in as well.
Is this a new enthusiasm, the cocktail, particularly in London?
No, I don't think so. I think it's been going strong since Dick's Bar at the Atlantic sort of revived the cocktail. It took a little bit of a downturn during some quite tacky years, but I don't think it's not a particularly recent resurgence in enthusiasm.
But there were typical British cocktails like Pimm's Cups and things. You're way beyond that now, right?
No, I think that the emphasis is now on classicism more than ever.
And tell us, is it the English classicist or is it like the martini? American martini, what?
Well, the American martini comes from a drink called a Martinez, which is a New York-style drink. But the martini, has a lot of its roots in English culture as well, with James Bond and all the rest of it.
What else do you know about cocktails that you need to share with us?
Well, like I said, I think the emphasis nowadays is, certainly in London, is on classicism and references to things done right in the past.
Okay, now when you say things done right, now do you do everything from scratch? Do you do your own bitters? Do you squeeze your own juices?
We squeeze our own juices, but we don't really indulge in homemade products of any kind, really. The products that are available on the market now are of such good quality that it's for some people, it's not for us.
Okay, so what distinguishes your cocktail program here at Quo Vadis?
Ice. We're one of the only bars I know without an ice well behind the bar.
Without
an ice well. So we have two dump freezers rather than a well that's like a room temperature well that the ice is kept in.
I'm not sure I understand that.
Can you imagine that a bartender would stand over his speed rail with a chest full of ice,
yes,
and a chest full of crushed ice? We actually have a refrigerated unit, a freezer unit there, to provide, good quality hand-cut ice in all of our drinks.
Oh, okay, hand-cut ice. And you probably cut it to order according to the requirements of the drink?
No, we have to cut it in advance. I wish we're a little bit too busy to cut it all to order.
I see. And did you hear me talking to Eddie about this, Grant Atkins' new bar in Chicago that has a flash freezer, separate special hand, custom-made molds, and they offer 18 varieties of ice?
I'd like to think that we were a little thing to do with that starting, actually. We were the first people to really pull that off at any volume.
Oh, no, you do that. Tell me.
Not 18 types of ice, but we were the first people 3 years ago to pull off custom ice at any kind of volume.
Okay, tell me what kinds of ice you're talking about.
We have a type of a column ice, which we use for our highballs, a hand-cut block for our sort of down-style drinks, like in Negronis, Old Fashions and whatnot, hand-cut cracked ice, hand-cracked ice, and block ice, which we use for shaking egg white-style drinks, like a Clover Club or a Whiskey Sour.
Do you create new cocktails yourself, personally?
When they're good enough to go on the menu, yeah. But we tend to, again, like I said, we're classicists. We tend to stick to what we know is good.
So what are your biggest sellers in cocktails?
Our house cocktail is the one I described to you earlier on, the Quo Vadis Aperitivo, which is a big hit in the restaurant, which is Campari with fresh clementine, lemon sugar, and cava.
And we had one at the restaurant the other day, which was Campari, Blood Orange, and what? I can't remember what the other one was. But I hadn't had Campari in years. I was so thrilled.
Yeah, I mean, Campari is enjoying a real resurgence. It's an acquired taste, but thankfully a lot of people work hard to acquire it.
We were speculating when we were talking about that resurgence of Campari. Whatever happened to Dubonnet? Did it disappear, or is it still around?
Still there. Drink of choice is the green of the Queen Mother, as I remember it. So hopefully it didn't pale away as she did.
But that's what the Queen Mother did.
Yeah, by royal appointment.
Do you have bar regulars?
We're a members club, so our customers are entirely regular. We see them all sort of 3-4 days a week.
Well, you know, I once knew a bartender that he was so good at, he'd see you once, and he would remember your favorite cocktail, what you were going to order, and so on. And it was, he cultivated this, and he said that was essential to be a good bartender. So, I mean, I wrote a piece called Blue Eyes Sazerac or something like that. In other words, he saw you and he remembered, there's your face, he remembered your cocktail. Do you have that kind of memory?
I'm not as good as I used to be, but I do okay.
So it is.
But Paul's being modest, because, you know, the guys here, at Quo Vadis are fantastic, Paul included. And, you know, one thing that, you know, that I'm very proud of is that although we have, you know, bar lists and drinks lists, you know, we like to, also kind of, you know, offer a service where, you know, rather than looking through, you know, a long list of drinks, which ours actually is quite, restrained. You know, that was one of our points. You know, we didn't want a cocktail list that, you know, offered all things to all men. You know, we wanted, a selection of really kind of hopefully, you know, well chosen drinks. But, you know, certainly kind of I encourage friends of mine, you know, who come up here either as members or friends of members to, you know, tell the bar team here what kind of day they've had, you know, what they're in the mood for, and then, you know, and let the kind of, you know, the experts try and guide them to a drink, you know, that's going to, you know, suit the moment. And I think that's really nice, you know, rather than, you know, if you're with a group of friends, you don't necessarily want to spend 5 or 10 minutes reading, you know, between the lines, you know, the ingredients. And, you know, but I think, you know, if, you know, carefully chosen questions, do you like gin? Do you like vodka? A long drink, a short drink? You know, and then, you know, hopefully, you know, the bar might recommend something they've either tried before or something new and exciting. So I think that's a really nice way, you know, a nice service to offer.
I know this is a dining and drinking club, but there is a bar on the ground floor also that the members of the public can come to?
That's right. In January this year, we opened, or rather changed, an area that was formerly part of the restaurant.
Okay, so it was part of the restaurant before.
And we've turned it into, you know, a drink and snack bar. And so really taken the expertise of Paul and his team from upstairs and, you know, now offer that to non-members and diners as well downstairs.
Oh, great. So you essentially can get the same thing just walking in off the street.
You can't have the privacy of the club rooms upstairs.
No, we're sitting in this sumptuous lounge, sinking into these sumptuous couches, surrounded by some rather fascinatingly exotic pieces of art that Anne was referring to earlier. I can imagine this is the kind of place where, I don't know, I think I told you this, Albert Knowles, you remember our old friend Albert Knowles, who was a member of the businessman's club in Pittsburgh called the Duquesne Club. And I was leaving one afternoon when Albert stormed into the club, hollered on the way in, "If anybody calls, I'm not here." I thought that was a terrific statement, and maybe you have members who do the same thing.
That's one of Eddie's tricks.
That's what Eddie does.
But downstairs, you know, what we hoped was that, you know, we've created a really kind of comfortable and you know, relatively sophisticated bar space, which is unlike, you know, we feel is kind of relatively unique in London. But it is open to the public, and you know, so one can go for, you know, a really great drink before either lunch or dinner, after lunch or dinner, or you can just go with a group of friends and have a cocktail in the evening or at lunchtime, in fact, you know, whenever you want. Paul has got a great team down there, and we've got a good selection of you know, bar snacks available as well.
Yes, I saw the menu. It looks good. It's not just snacks. I mean, there's good shellfish.
Not only look good, it smelled good when the fries and steak tartare arrived.
Have you always been active in bartending or not?
I don't know about active, but yes, I've been doing it for a long time.
How long time? You're young.
14 years.
Wow, okay.
So nearly half my life.
And you've escaped some of this madness that's gone on in the States, like I mean, I can't believe what's going to come up next with poor old vodka. I mean, they infuse it with everything.
Oh, they're doing it to gin now as well, unfortunately. But
oh, no, gin too.
Going back to what Paul said, you know, about where kind of London or the UK is in the world of cocktails, you know, I think I tend to agree with Paul that, you know, that obviously, in you know, we've taken a lot always from, you know, from the States. And, you know, the cocktails have gone through such a kind of roller coaster of an evolution, you know, over the last, you know, 20, 30 years, Paul, probably even longer, in the UK. But, you know, there was certainly, it reached a kind of, it's kind of, it's worst when we were putting umbrellas, you know, in in sweet and sickly kind of drinks. You know, but actually then one can also have quite a lot of fun with that. You know, there's actually a really well-made pina colada, I'm sure Paul will agree, actually is a fabulous drink. You know, but it's really got to be made well. And, you know, and I suppose, in my humble opinion, the difference between a well-made pina colada and one that was not so well made would be the inclusion of enough spirit to make it feel like, you know, taste like a cocktail, and not overly sweet. You know, that I think the 80s was a time of unnatural food colorings.
Oh, like those chocolate martinis.
Sweet, sticky cocktails. And, you know, and I think, you know, where Paul is, and certainly Sam, my brother and I, agree and encourage, is that the way forward is, Paul very humbly said that, you know, he doesn't, you know, spend his time in the lab designing new, but in fact, you know, the you know, Paul and his team, you know, have developed, you know, quite a few, you know, kind of, you know, cocktails of their own, but the majority are perfectly made classics. And of course, you know, it's rather like making a good cup of coffee. It's not just the bean. There's so many elements that go into making a really good cocktail, even if it might have three ingredients. And one might ask, you know, how difficult can it be? Well, it's, you know, it's the glass that it's served in. You know, is it nicely chosen?
Yeah.
Is it a beautiful glass? You know, is the ice right? Has it been shaken too long, too short? You know, is the exact balance of the ingredients just right to make the perfect drink? And, you know, I think it's so tempting, you know, whether you're a chef or whether you're, you know, behind the bar, to, you know, to elaborate. But actually, kind of, I think, you know, more often than not, it takes more confidence to be restrained, and that's something which is more difficult to achieve.
So, Paul, what's around the corner after the past and now the present? What do you think is the future for the cocktail?
I think staying on the path that we're on and paying good homage to the classics and not overcomplicating things is the only way to go.
Now, could I just ask, what cocktail do you drink?
Very rarely drink cocktails, believe it or not.
So what do you drink instead?
Gin and tonic, pretty much every
gin
time.
Gin and tonic, okay.
To a frightening degree.
Twist
some evenings.
Or not?
No, squeeze and lime.
And how about you, Eddie?
Well, Sam and I, when we're here at work, tend to, you know, drink either wine or beer, or like Paul, you know, a really kind of delicious gin and tonic. Going back to kind of, you know, your question, Peter, you know, about, you know, what's around the corner. I think people are taking more interest in products, and although we all know that, you know, vodka is a saturated market with rather frustrating kind of mad ideas of vodka, but, you know, but there are also some, you know, some good products out there, and, you know, good new products. I tasted some good vodkas actually recently. I was saying vodka's saturated, but, you know, I think bars are taking interest in making sure the back bar is full of interesting things. One of our members donated a bottle of ancient kind of 1892 Absinthe to the bar.
Now, how different is that from today's Absinthe?
Immeasurably different colour, entirely, well, not entirely different taste, but has more dimensions to it, I suppose. Much more complex.
Also, that same generous member donated a bottle of 1904
old rye whiskey. Yeah.
Old rye.
Rye's coming back. There's a big resurgence in rye in the States, I know.
Is there?
Yeah.
But, you know, so all these kind of interesting kind of, you know, bottles behind the bar, I think, add, you know, add to the kind of, you know, the interest of the drinkers.
Well, thank you for I mean, I know you have tons of things to do because you...
It's my pleasure.
Thanks so much. We always count on a lot of information and support from our friend Eddie Hart. Eddie, tell us exactly what's... First of all, update us on what you've been doing, you and your brother.
Well, thank you very much for your kind words. We have, since we last saw each other, which was now 2 years ago?
No, 1 year.
It's 1 year.
Time. We do this every year. We check in with you.
Well, you're very kind. In the last year, we've really been keeping our heads down. And by that, I mean in terms of new projects. Britain, as I'm sure, you know, you've experienced in the States, you know, economics have not been easy, you know, over the last couple of years. But we've been working hard to settle Quo Vadis, our most recent
inn.
Which
is where we are right now.
And that takes a while. And I think Sam and I had forgotten with our first restaurant, Fino. It had taken, you know, a number of years for us to walk in through the door, whether it be in the morning, you know, before lunch service or in the afternoon, and feel happy that most things were under control.
And it's still going well, Fino.
Fino is enjoying a really good period at the moment, our Spanish restaurant, and we took part in Gordon Ramsay's best restaurant at the end of last year, and in fact got to the semi-final. So that was, although TV isn't really something that Sam and I are too interested in, it was excellent for the restaurant, and resulted in lots of kind of bums on seats. So that was that was great towards the end of last year. And at Quo Vadis, we've just taken on a new general manager who worked for 5 years at Racine.
I'm sure you know, Racine, with
Henry Harris, next door to Harrods there. And he's an excellent front of house man. And I know that when he was at Racine, they won all sorts of awards for front of house service. So, you know, it's early days. He's been with us about a fortnight now, but he's making quick progress in just kind of polishing up, you know, all sorts of, service bits and pieces. So that's really exciting for us. And we still keep holding off with an idea to open a second Barrafina, which is our small L-shaped bar tapas restaurant next door here.
Yeah, we talked about that. And we were there last year.
That's right, exactly. So we've been holding off on...
That's a nice place, actually. I forgot about that, yeah.
Well, that's our little jewel in the crown.
I would love it, yeah.
And small seems beautiful, certainly in London at the moment. And in fact, there's all sorts of restaurants I can think of here in the area in Soho that are small and beautiful in the sense that, you know, that they've been extremely kind of successful in the last couple of years. Polpo, I can think of, you know, obviously the Venetian Cicchetti restaurant on Beak Street in Soho.
What's it called?
Polpo. P-O-L-P-O. And,
which is octopus.
And opened by a gentleman called Russell Norman, who used to work for the Ivy and Caprice Group.
Oh, wow.
For about 10 years. So he was...
Big change for him. Yeah.
They actually, in the last, I would say, 18 months, or maybe two and a half years, have opened another two restaurants along the same scale. And there's Bocca di Lupo, another small Italian restaurant with a substantial amount of the restaurant devoted to, you know, kind of a bar dining. And with open kitchens often, you know, there seems to be a direction that it seems to be middle market restaurants that really seem to be, you know, succeeding.
Well, this is true of the States too in many ways, although there's still high-end places. But you don't get these gangbuster palaces of dining.
Now, you did mention earlier on that a chef called Jason Atherton, who was Gordon Ramsay protege, is opening soon.
Jason ran Maze, which was Ramsay's kind of, I suppose, not tapas quite, but, you know, lots of small dishes. And the first Maze opened in Grosvenor Square and was extremely successful, and I'm sure still is. But since then, Jason parted company with Ramsay Holdings about 12 months ago, if not a little longer, and embarked on his own project, which is always, you know, fascinating to see, you know, when people have, you know, worked so long for a big name, and when they you know, go solo. So I mean, that's certainly kind of one of the openings of this year that's my brother Sam and I are most excited.
And that's about to happen.
Like all these projects, it's been delayed. I think they were meant to open in November of last year,
okay.
Or possibly even before, maybe October.
Now, but today they were supposed to be opening the Georges Vaugirardin's Spice Market in the new W here. Did that happen?
Now, do you know what? I'm afraid that's kind of passed me by on the radar. I'm not quite sure why, but I'm ashamed to say that I wasn't aware of that. But I'm not quite sure whether the W Hotel is,
I'm not sure,
you know, is on schedule or not. Actually, another interesting place opening opposite the W Hotel is it in Leicester Square, the one that you're thinking of?
I think it is.
And is Fergus Henderson of St. John.
He
bought a very famous old institution called Manzi's, which is tucked just behind Leicester Square, and he's taken over the building and opening I believe it's 19 bedrooms, or it might be a few more, a hotel with a restaurant and bar.
God bless
and,
him.
and you know, he's a dear friend of ours, but also anything he does, you know, we look forward to great anticipation.
Nice man. And of course we know with the going on with the Mandarin Oriental, with the Barbaloo and the dinner by Hester Blumenthal.
That's been really interesting. And, you know, I think if there's a trend, you know, we've talked about small restaurants, you know, middle market. And I think, you know, what's interesting about both Barbaloo, which I have been to only once, and dinner, which seems impossible to get a table in, but I've certainly read, you know, read articles on it, is that, you know, is this lack of table. And I don't know whether we're ever going to look back in the way that we used to. You know, I mean, it wasn't that long ago. If one take, you know, goes back 20 years, a restaurant of any quality, the majority of restaurants of quality, one had to have a tablecloth. That was just the way it was. Right. And I think, you know, what's, you know, Barbaloo, I think, is obviously a kind of a bistro de luxe style type of restaurant. But certainly with dinner from Heston Blumenthal, you know, I think fascinating to see, you know, no tablecloths there.
So, and in general trends, okay, smaller, more casual restaurants, no tablecloths. What about ethnic? I mean, different kinds of ethnic. There seems to be like anything you'd want. Coming here to your place, past an Italian vegetarian restaurant, which I'd never even heard of.
I'm not quite sure that the Italians knew what vegetarian was.
I know. I mean, I could see how you could construct a vegetarian meal easily with Italian ingredients, because they're not all that big, unless you were doing a Florentine steak. They're not big meat eaters. Oh, pigs, I guess.
I think what's interesting, and what certainly Sam and I have seen, is obviously there's always been, you know, ethnic food in Britain and London, you know, starting with the Italians, perhaps. I'm sure it started with
the French
the French before that. But, you know, certainly kind of French, Italian, Chinese has been big. In the last 10 years, Japanese has made, you know, a huge kind of leap forward. But I think what people in our mind are interested now, that the foodies are interested in, is the real deal. So, you know, whereas Indian food in this country tended to be Indian food designed for the British palate,
yeah.
As with Japanese to a certain extent. I often read in foodie press, Japanese light, and that is, you know, coming from foodies, and it's rather an insulting term for not the real deal. And what we find is that, you know, people, you know, the world has become smaller, and people have travelled to Japan, they've travelled to, you know, to the real Spain, for example, which obviously, you know, kind of, you know, has, you know, has an effect on us. And we notice that people are now, you know, taking much more interest in, you know, in sherry. They're taking interest in, you know, they know what arroz negro is, you know, squid ink risotto. You know, there's the knowledge is so much more in depth than it was previously.
Do you know Portuguese food too? That's sort of starting to make inroads into the United States.
Yeah, in fact, there's a restaurant here called Via Janta or Via Janta that we were supposed to go to, but the chef is out of the country.
Do you know Portuguese?
I believe Via Janta is that quite molecular in its style?
I don't really know. We know the chef is Portuguese, and that's and apparently doing very well. And we read about him in an article in Decanter that included Massimo Bottura from Osteria Francescana, and also, but Claude Bosi. Was also there. So I think it was just, and the guy from Noma was included as well.
Now, you went to Noma. Give us a little report, since it's going to be 7 years before we get in.
Noma, you know, obviously, I'm not entirely in agreement with the title best restaurant in the world, but, you know, there we are, these things happen. I think, you know, that in itself is a ridiculous title to award, you know, any restaurant. But I was, you know, by mistake, I got a reservation. I rather, like you, feared that it might be years before I was kind of packing my bags and heading off to Copenhagen. But I wasn't disappointed in the slightest. The service I was particularly taken aback by, possibly the best service I've ever had, but yet without any of the formalities of, you know, old three-star service, you know, that one, you know, maybe has experienced in the past. I mean, one of the really interesting things was that the food was brought to you by the chefs, all of whom were immaculate in kind of unsplattered aprons. You know, I believe there's no flames in their kitchens. So they didn't even have burns or scalds or on their hands. And they were charming. They all spoke English, because I think it's so international now, Noma. But I thought the food, although we went at a time of year where foraging is not, you know, it's not the best moment for it, there was still fabulously interesting forage food, and it very witty, rather like when years ago I managed to get a table at El Bulli. Similar, it was just, you know, there was so much humour and wit in the food, beautifully executed. And if you can get a table, I'd highly recommend it. And Copenhagen's a great city, great bars, some, you know, good cocktail scene going on in Copenhagen as well.
Well, as usual, you were filled with information, and we love talking to you. And
lovely
keep
talking
us
to
posted.
You.
Yes. Let us know what your next venture will be.
We certainly will do.
Thanks. Bye.
Stay with us while we take a short break, because there's more on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Hello again. Another old friend that we can't resist dropping in on, especially when he has new things happening, is Rolly Lee, a seasoned, savvy pro that we like a lot. He gives it to you straight.
And he dishes a little dirt, too.
He does. but he also now has a whole new venture, which is a more casual cafe inside his restaurant, along with an oyster bar.
And he's a lovely man.
Oh, he is wonderful.
And curiously enough, as if we were not wrapping the entire program around, it turns out that Rolly, not so many years ago, actually owned the restaurant place called Launceston Place, where we, yeah. where we started out last Sunday's adventure.
Right.
So here we are now then with Rolly at Le Café Anglais, just off Queensway, talking about his new... The new features, I guess.
New features of his
of Le Café Anglais, and a few other things as well.
We're catching up with what's new in the life and habits of Rolly Lee, chef extraordinaire. Rolly, tell us about your new oyster bar.
Well, we're sitting in it, and as you can see, it's a rather splendid bar with stools all around, with this magnificent Art Deco chandelier hanging over it.
Yeah, where'd you get that? Is it a reproduction?
We bought that from an architect. No, it's original.
Is it?
We bought it from an architectural salvage site, and it used to be in the ballroom of the Hyde Park Hotel, and it was installed there in 1993.
It's gorgeous.
Taken out some 20 years ago, and
wow.
we've had it restored. And it is a gorgeous thing.
It is gorgeous. Yeah, I don't know how you clean on those, but that's a
thing.
Well,
nor do we yet. It's that new.
So, okay, so your concept is an oyster bar.
It's more than that. It's a cafe and oyster bar. So
okay.
What we're trying to do in a little way is Café Anglais Light, because, you know, I wanted to do here a big brasserie, but I wanted to make it more comfortable than my previous restaurant. Okay, so the restaurant became progressively just a little bit too grand almost, and people began to feel as though they needed to come here on a special occasion.
Oh,
and
that's
great.
Good,
I mean, that's great if people come here for special occasions, and we've got a certain grandeur, and it's extremely comfortable, and we've got tablecloths and very good service, but it's just slightly formal. So we wanted to slightly tone that down and introduce something that was more everyday, but very special. So it seemed to me logical that every grand French brasserie has an oyster bar at the front. So we took that idea and married that in also to the idea of having a cafe. So we got a very simple cafe menu with plat du jour and soups and omelettes, all at very, very low price. So the idea is that our regulars might come here three times a week, just on the off chance when they go to the cinema, and then once a week into the restaurant. And that's how it's panning out. It's working very well. Yeah.
How many kinds of oysters do you have?
Only six.
Okay.
It's shameful compared to New York standards, where
Aqua
Grill's got 150 different oysters on at the same time. But we don't have the same sort of culture in a way.
Right. But oysters are catching on. We've had them three times since we've been here.
Have you? Yeah.
Just in a week.
Now, the ones we had were French, though. You're sourcing mostly
Fine
from...
Claire.
Mostly from England?
We have one Fine Claire, yeah, from Arcachon. And then we have... one rock oyster from Northern Ireland, and we have about five different oysters from Essex, which is the original Colchester oysters, is where the longest culture of oysters in the British Isles.
And these are natural, they're not farmed?
Oh, some are farmed, some are wild.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, the difference between farmed and wild is so narrow,
is
really,
killed.
When you come talking about an oyster.
And
even a wild bed is encouraged.
And listen, we might as well dispel this whole myth about only eating oysters when there is an R in the month.
Oh, please.
Well, that's true of the rock oyster, but it's still true. It's not, I mean, it's not a myth when it comes to the native oyster, which is a different species, which I'm not sure you have much over in the States.
I think most everything is cultivated.
Right.
And it's such a fine product.
No, except it's one of the few places where they're not totally disappearing in, as a wild culture.
Now, what I was thinking about was it used to take 2 days by coach to get a Colchester oyster to London, by which time you might not want to eat it. That was the story I always heard.
I think it has to do more with not molting. What do you call it? With their propagating.
Well,
they lose their fat and there's.
Yeah, no, exactly. Now, what's happened is that it's not the R in the month is entirely about the breeding season.
Oh,
that's
it is.
What I said.
So they're laying their eggs.
And the native
the
oyster still has a classic breeding season through the summer months, i.e., from. April, from May onwards, i.e. when there isn't an R in the month, and they do go very milky and thin, and they're not particularly nice.
Right.
And they don't really start to fatten up and clear their liquor and become really good again until sort of third week in September. Yeah.
But it was an unusual guy, I think. I think it was Jonathan Swift who said Brave was the man who first ate an oyster.
Absolutely. So you'd be surprised how brave the English are now. And and there's a misconception that it's a man's food, and that's not true. A lot of women now are eating oysters.
Oh, yeah, I thought, I never think of it as a man's food.
If we had 24 between us, I would have to battle hard to get my 12.
Yeah, the other thing I hear that's really hot in the British restaurant scene is razor clams. Are you dealing with those?
Yeah, I've always cooked razor clams.
Have you?
I think we probably had them in a dish the last time we were here,
and
we talked about them.
Yeah, they're delicious, lovely things.
Yeah, I love them too. Yeah.
Let's just recap for everybody, because this is not really the easiest place to find if you're looking for 8 Porchester Gardens. In fact, our cab driver didn't bring us straight to the door. I said, "I remember you turned left here," but imagine that you're on a major street called Queensway.
That's right.
And you'll see Porchester Gardens. You'll recognize that from a big building which used to be an old something called Whiteley's.
It used to be a very grand department store, and built in 1911. And as you can see, it's a magnificent Art Deco building. The rest of the store is now a shopping mall, which has seen better times. We hope it will see better times again.
Now, what's your website, Rolly?
The website is www.lecafeanglais.co.uk. And I'm sure if you ask a cab driver, take me to the Café Anglais, he'll get you here.
Okay, maybe we're just speaking the wrong language.
Could be.
Rolly, it's such a pleasure to catch up with you. I think when I was planning this trip, you were the first person to respond to an email, and that was last September. And we've been corresponding since then. And, I forgot to... You were just in Italy, weren't you?
Just now. I just got back last night.
Oh, yeah. Tell us about
There were some other guys that we met here who were along.
Was this in Modena? Modena, Italy.
Yes, sorry, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
There was a crew of chefs from here who were over there.
I was with Jeremy Lee of the Blueprint Cafe and Mark Hicks of Hicks, who ran the Caprice Group for many years. And that was it, really, and a couple of other guys. But those boys have got some stamina, I can tell you. I'm the old man of the party now. I go to bed early and leave them to...
Did you have a good time?
We had a great time. We looked at balsamic vinegar, traditional manufacturer.
Yeah,
balsamic
vinegar.
To be honest, that was looking at rather a lot of barrels.
Yeah.
Wasn't the most stimulating thing. And then we got up very early in the morning the next day and went and watched cows being milked and Parmesan being made. And we saw the whole process of Parmesan from cow to store. And being stamped, and it was absolutely fascinating. I'm a big Parmesan fan, as you know.
Yeah. Did our buddy Massimo Bottura have you there? I mean, it's called the
Osteria Francescana
in Modena now? Oh, good restaurant.
One of the world's top half dozen restaurants, in our humble opinion. So next time they invite you to Modena, you got to go there.
You should have told me. We went to an old fashioned, very very traditional trattoria, which we absolutely loved.
So you had a great time anyway.
Oh, we had a great time. Yeah.
Well, it's great to see you again. And
not sure if my liver did, but the rest
yeah, the liver is an issue.
Well, I don't know whether we'll edit that out or not. We'll have to see how we feel. Rolly, a pleasure to see you once more.
And you.
Thanks, Rolly.
Well, it feels like a shame to leave London behind, doesn't it?
Well, yes, it does.
but we also haven't entirely given up on, because we did have one exciting adventure that we couldn't document with an interview because we didn't meet Uber chef Heston Blumenthal, but we did get a chance, against all odds, to get a reservation and have lunch at Dinner by Heston, and Anne's hot on his trail. So if we have the opportunity to bring him to you in a future program, yeah, we'll certainly do that.
We've interviewed him before, but I really expect that he might just walk through the dining room.
You can just never tell. So we'll see what happens, and in the meantime, we'll see you again, same place, next week.
Bye-bye.